From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Less than 1 hour from now, President George W. Bush will step to the podium on Capitol Hill and deliver his 2005 State of the Union address. Just 13 days after his inaugural, President Bush is expected to climb down tonight from that speech's high call for freedom to speak more pointedly to the business he has put before the nation, war in Iraq and social security reform at home. Both are volatile subjects with plenty of impact on the State of the Union. In the next hour, before the president speaks, we'll get a wider take on the State of the Union. We'll talk with Arianna Huffington, with the governors of Pennsylvania and North Dakota, with John Fund of the Wall Street Journal, with What's the Matter with Kansas author Thomas Frank, and more. Tonight on Point, sizing up the State of the Union as we prepare to hear the president's State of the Union address. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you see the State of the Union in January 2005? How could we build a more perfect union? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin tonight with a preview of the President's State of the Union address. Karen Tumulty is national political correspondent for Time magazine. She joins me from Washington. Karen, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you.
Karen, what is President Bush's mission on Capitol Hill tonight?
Well, the steepest hill that he has got to climb tonight is on that subject of Social Security. He has put out Social Security revamping of the system, particularly allowing people to divert part of their Social Security taxes into private savings accounts as his single biggest domestic priority of his second term. And it is getting I think the most charitable thing you can say about it is a guarded reaction, even from Republicans on Capitol Hill.
So he's hitting some headwind on that even before he formally unveils anything. And the word is he's not going to lay out the details tonight, but how is he going to try and frame this tonight? Not, we're told, in terms of a Social Security crisis, but something else?
Well, it's interesting. He used the word crisis certainly after the election through December, and essentially had, you know, every time he would use that word, he was refuted by experts in the field, because of course there is not a crisis in the sense of sort of an imminent collapse of the Social Security system. So the White House is trying to figure out, you know, what is the right language here to convince people that there is something going on with the system that needs fixing. The problem here is that the solution that they are proposing does nothing to solve the solvency crisis of the Social Security system. In fact, diverting money into private accounts actually brings the date of insolvency that much closer, because that's money that cannot be used then to pay the benefits of current beneficiaries.
So to get to solvency, you've either got to raise new revenues or cut the benefits. Will the president speak to either of those tonight?
That is the big question, and I think the betting right now is that he will not, and because the White House has all but ruled out higher taxes, and every time he mentions cutting benefits, of course, that's when everybody in Congress starts running for the hills.
On the foreign policy front, the president is sure to talk a lot about the what's perceived as rather successful elections in Iraq over the weekend. Can he wrap that around his domestic agenda as well? Does he get momentum on all fronts from that, Karen?
Well, he tried to do that a little bit in the inaugural address, where he sort of put it all under the rubric of freedom. And he's going to sell this plan as giving people ownership of their Social Security accounts. Of course, that the problem there is that the basic premise of the Social Security program, when it was established under Franklin Roosevelt in 1935, it was not about freedom and ownership. It was about security and a basic safety net.
Stepping back from Social Security, it is the State of the Union address. We're going to be talking about different people's assessment of what that state is tonight. How do you think the president is likely to characterize this moment? He's starting a second term. He's got a full term behind him already. What's the State of the Union, the condition of the Union that he's likely to describe?
Well, he is going to certainly, and on the foreign front, take a sort of victory lap for the Iraqi elections, you know, which follow the elections in Afghanistan, and are likely to be, you know, portrayed as the third in a set of sort of triumphs of democracy. If you add the Ukraine, he will certainly point to what appears to be a strengthening economy as well at home. So, you know, I think the sort of standing line on these addresses is the president stands up there and says the state of our union is strong.
And we will no doubt hear that tonight. Karen Tumulty, we know you'll be watching. We'll be listening right along. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time Magazine. We're joined now from Philadelphia by Pennsylvania Governor Edward Rendell, a Democrat elected to office in 2003. From 92 to 99, he was mayor of Philadelphia. Edward Rendell, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, although just to be accurate, I'm in Harrisburg.
Oh, excuse me.
That's okay.
Harrisburg. Glad to have you from Harrisburg. Governor Rendell, step back for a moment with us. The president will say, as Karen Tumulty says, the State of the Union is strong. Work it up a little more. If you were to describe the State of the Union, the condition of the country tonight, what would your big characterization be?
Well, I think the country's the State of the Union cannot be accurately described as strong. I think we're facing some enormous challenges, and I'd say the State of the Union is at a crossroads. Certainly health care in America is at a point where it's about to explode and drown American businesses and take children and seniors who desperately need health care down with it. And that pervades virtually everything we do. Our Social Security system and our Medicaid and Medicare systems, which are the bulwark of the safety net that makes the American democracy different than any other country in the world, those are all on shaky grounds. I think we all acknowledge that. The economy, although showing some slight improvement, is very shaky. The January stock market yield was terrible, and that's been a pretty good forecaster of what happens over the year. Mm. Although we've created some jobs, they are in the low-wage sector of the economy. We still continue to lose high-wage jobs. And so I think we've got a nation at the crossroads, and what this nation does not need, and the American people overwhelmingly agree with it, we do not need making these tax cuts permanent. Given the war, given the cost that the war and the fight on terrorism, homeland security, given all of those costs that have been added upon our normal challenges, this is the time when Americans should sacrifice, and we should certainly roll back all of those tax cuts on Americans earning more than $200,000. I'm just looking at a poll that says 86% of Americans don't think cutting taxes, making the tax cuts permanent, are worth cutting Medicaid for needy children or seniors.
Governor Rendell, let me ask you then. President Bush almost certainly tonight is going to look at this crossroads, as you described anyway, and the tonic that he recommends will be, I'm guessing, something like freedom and ownership, the ownership society. What's the rallying cry, the banner that you would put up at this crossroads?
We're all for freedom and ownership, and I heard your discussion with Karen Tumulty, and I think the president deserves to take a victory lap for what happened in Iraq on Sunday. Just as an American citizen, forget being a Democrat, it was inspiring to watch the joy and the sense of jubilation on behalf of an overwhelming number of Iraqi citizens. And that doesn't mean the election's perfect, and without Sunni participation, that country could break up into civil war as soon as our troops leave. But still, it was a triumph for freedom. It was a triumph for democracy, and we all agree with that, and we all ought to stand up and applaud the president for that.
And we do, but your alternate message to his freedom and ownership, are you saying sacrifice and more taxes?
Not sacrifice. No, not more taxes. We just don't want to make the tax cuts permanent for Americans earning $200,000 a year, and that includes my wife and I, because we think that the country has challenges. And I was going to run through some stats. In the 80s and 75%, Americans don't believe it's worth making those tax cuts permanent to cut education funding, to cut Social Security funding, to cut transportation funding, to cut environmental protections, scientific research. The American people are almost uniform in the fact that they want the challenges facing us met. They don't want the richest, 1-2% of Americans to get permanent tax cuts.
Governor Rendell, we've got it. It sounds like the message is face the challenges. We appreciate your being with us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania tonight.
Right.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
We're at a crossroads, and we have to stand up and be counted for the American values that are important to all of us.
We've got it loud and clear. Edward Rendell, Governor of Pennsylvania, thank you very much for being with us. I'm joined now by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, 50 minutes now? The president will be at the podium, Republicans and Democrats, and, of course, considerably more Republicans than Democrats in this Congress after last November, and the president will give his view of the state of the union. It's going to be Iraq and Social Security, and then, of course, there'll be some kind of laundry list in there. But the big push, the big mission that you see him on this moment?
It's Karl Rove's grand plan that he's on. This is what Stephen Moore calls it in today's Los Angeles Times. And the grand plan is to make the GOP the majority party for the next generation. And it has several elements. Social Security is an effort to appeal to young voters, peel them away. Immigration reform to appeal to Latinos. Tort reform, a way of defunding Democrats because it'll hit at trial lawyers. But above all, and the unavowed strategy, of course, is starve the beast, create a fiscal crisis in governance such that there will be a permanent constituency for tax cuts forever. The federal revenues now are at lower level than they've been since the 1950s before we had Medicare and Medicaid. They're 16% of GDP. Spending is 20%. That's already a big hole. And if you look at it this way, and Rove has been explicit about this, starve the beast is a way to create a constituency for tax cuts because people aren't getting anything for their taxes.
So the beast being the government, if it's not delivering because there's no resources there, then
people say, take it away.
It's a downward kind of spiral that the GOP leadership would like to see.
Well, I mean, they will not come out and say they want deficits and debt, but that's what drives it. In this sense, then, the Social Security plan, which is going to cost a lot of money politically, is what they want. That's good news because it's going to mean people are going to get less from government.
A trillion here, a trillion there. It might line up with that kind of goal. Jack Beatty, stand by. We're going to hear from a lot more folks tonight. We're talking about the State of the Union in advance of the President's State of the Union address. Listeners, you can join this conversation. How do you see the state of the American Union tonight? How could we build a more perfect union? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the state of the American Union in advance of the President's State of the Union address at 9 p.m. Eastern in under an hour now in Washington. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you see the state of the Union tonight? Are you eager to get on the president's Social Security bandwagon, or are you ducking for cover? What do you want to hear from the president tonight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're sizing up the State of the Union tonight with perspectives from both sides of the political aisle. North Dakota's Republican Governor John Hoeven is in Washington and will be in the hall for tonight's State of the Union address. Tomorrow, President Bush heads to North Dakota to promote Social Security privatization. I asked Governor Hoeven what he thinks is the most important thing for the president to say tonight.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to the State of the Union, and I think citizens throughout America are looking forward to it. And he's going to talk about his plan for the future of our country. And that involves not only national security, but continuing to build this economy and make sure that government works for the people of America.
And then tomorrow morning, you'll be on a plane with the president, Air Force One in particular, flying out to North Dakota. He's coming into Fargo as part of his barnstorming for Social Security reform. He'll be speaking in Fargo. Who's going to show up to support the president's message there, and who's staying home? What's North Dakota look like on Social Security?
Well, first, we're having some nice, wonderful, warm weather now, so the timing's great, and we're looking forward to having the president out in North Dakota. As a matter of fact, we got clearance from the White House to try to set up the largest venue possible. Based on security, that's a venue that holds around 7,000 people, and in about 40 minutes, all the tickets were taken. So there's a real enthusiasm out there to hear from the president.
But does that mean that North Dakotans want to see Social Security partially privatized? You've got two Democratic U.S. senators from North Dakota, both of them, Kent Conrad, Byron Dorgan, both of them oppose it. What about the people of North Dakota?
Well, I think the people of North Dakota are anxious to hear from the president. Again, I think we all want to strengthen Social Security, and we're looking for ways to do that. The president is taking a leadership role in addressing the challenge, and now is the time for people to come together and come up with good solutions. And so I think the people of North Dakota are anxious to hear what the president has to say, and they're also anxious for their elected leaders to work together on these challenges and come up with good solutions.
But there's been a lot of resistance. Do you think people are open to the idea of privatizing as a solution?
Well, I think we have to hear what the president has to say about personal accounts and go from there. And clearly, you know, there's going to be a lot of dialogue and discussion, a lot of work done on this. But we do need to address Social Security. I think we all recognize that and strengthen it, not only now, but for the future.
Governor Hovind, George Bush is just coming back into office, but of course in his second term that lame duck thing comes on pretty quickly. How long do you think he's got to do this major earth moving that he's got in mind?
You know, that's hard for me to predict something like that, and I'm not sure I would. I think what we see from President Bush, though, is that he puts forward a strong agenda, he pursues it vigorously, and he wants to get people to work with him to address the challenges we face. And I think that is leadership. I think that is the right way to approach it, and I know he's going to continue to do that.
Do you think President Bush can stand in front of Congress and the country tonight and say that he has improved the State of the Union?
Well, clearly, you know, particularly in terms of 9/11 and how he reacted, the leadership he showed, and what he's done, not only in terms of Homeland Security, but in terms of really bringing freedom, working to create security around the world, strong leadership role there, but also reducing the tax burden on our citizens, and again, very forthrightly and directly addressing the major challenges that we face.
And tomorrow morning, you'll be with him on Air Force One. First ride on Air Force One, Governor?
Well, first time we've been in the air. I've actually been on the plane before. He'd taken me out one time, showed me around a little bit, but this will be the first time in the air. So looking forward to it very much.
Governor John Hovind, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Good to talk to you.
John Hovind is Republican governor of North Dakota. He spoke with me from Washington, where he will be attending tonight's State of the Union address. On Point News analyst Jack Beattie is with me. Jack, there's a governor excited about a ride on Air Force One tomorrow, and all behind the president, who he sees as giving direct, forthright leadership and asking people to come on board.
Yes, and he's saying that now, but in the offing, the administration is contemplating changing the Medicaid formula in such a way that the states will have to, you know, that now they take half of it, that more of it, in effect, more of it would be shifted onto them. And Republican governors already are saying no. So if they try to go ahead with this, this governor with other Republican governors is going to say, oh, no, we want to stay with what the old formula.
As I recall, North Dakota has a markedly aging population. He's not going to want more of that Medicaid bill out there.
No.
Jack Beattie, stand by. We're going to be hearing from a lot of folks tonight on their views of the State of the Union. We're joined right now from New York City by John Fund, columnist with the Wall Street Journal's opinionjournal.com. John Fund, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Pleasure.
And from Beverly Hills, California, we're joined by Arianna Huffington, a nationally syndicated columnist and author of Fanatics and Fools, The Game Plan for Winning Back America. Arianna Huffington, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
John Fund, first to you. State of the Union on this January night, how do you see it?
Well, it is February.
Oh, excuse me.
You know, time flies when you're having fun.
Yes, it does. I can't keep up.
No, the president has obviously got twin challenges here. He has to lay out a very complex, I think, explanation of his Social Security plan to an audience that is not quite ready for it. And secondly, he has to, I think, both celebrate the elections in Iraq and also point out that there's an awful lot of hard work to go. And I think those are daunting challenges. On the other hand, the president does have a reservoir of goodwill. Since the election, his approval ratings are, while modest, are still above 50%. So the audience is not with him, but the audience is willing to listen.
The audience is not with him on either front, Iraq or Social Security, or what do you mean exactly?
Well, the president has approval ratings between 50 and 55%, and that means that he's got a base of support, but there's an awful lot of the country that's going to be skeptical.
And he's got to speak to them as well as to his base. He's not just got to win a 51% election anymore.
Well, I have to tell you, in Congress on Social Security, we may be looking at that because the Democrats, I guess with their new motto, just say never, have already announced before the president's plan has been proposed that they effectively are all going to oppose it and they're going to filibuster it. I find that astonishing. I mean, there are no details of the president's plan out. I've seen the early draft. It's substantially different from what their leaks were. And I have to tell you, I find it very interesting that a party would automatically say, we're going to reject whatever the president puts on the table even before we see it.
Details not there, but of course the general shape has been described. Arianna Huffington, we want to hear from you tonight on Iraq, on Social Security, but what about just the big picture? We heard from Governor Rendell a few minutes ago. He said he sees America at a crossroads. He says we've got to face up to challenges. Of course, he's a Democratic governor. He's not sure that President Bush is doing that. But how do you see that? The general framework, the big frame of the union tonight, how are we doing?
Well, I agree with you. I think we need to look at the big frame, and we need to look at it without pretending that all is well, without pretending that we are spreading freedom and democracy abroad, without using the kind of soaring rhetoric that the president used in his inaugural address and is, I'm sure, going to be using again tonight, because despite the fact that there were elections in Iraq and that people braved the insurgents and turned out to vote, the truth is that Iraq is a debacle, and nothing last Sunday changed that.
It sure didn't look like a debacle. With all those Iraqis lining up, risking their lives to vote, that looked pretty good.
Well, that may look very good to you, but the truth is that this is not democracy. This is still an American occupation, and they're voting just as much to get us out as they're voting for anything else. And the truth is that there's an enormous amount that's gone wrong there, including the latest report from the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction that shows that $9 billion are unaccounted. I mean, there has to be some accountability for what's happening there, for the fact that we are spending billions of dollars. The president has just asked for another $80 billion. Mm. And therefore, many domestic priorities, including education, including health care, are not being addressed. That, for me, is the central challenge we are facing, and I'd love to hear the president address that.
So despite those full ballot boxes in Iraq, you're not willing to give him credit on that front. What about on the domestic front? The Social Security proposals, broad as they may be tonight, are the biggest domestic piece coming down the pike. What do you think of where the White House is headed on Social Security reform?
Well, first of all, it's unfortunate that the White House has chosen to address Social Security before it's addressing the health care crisis, the Medicare crisis. They are kind of pretending that there is a crisis in Social Security, while what we are facing is a major crisis in health care. 45 million people uninsured, 11 million of them children, and an aging population, and skyrocketing costs. I mean, that's the greatest crisis we're facing.
What does it say to you about priorities, then, if Social Security comes first?
Well, that's because the president wants to privatize it. That's because the president wants to do something more for his corporate interests and his Wall Street corporate funders than he's already done by giving them a huge tax cut in the middle of a war, which, as you know, is unprecedented and which has led to these record deficits.
John Fund, how about that? How do you read the president's fundamental commitment here to bringing some privatization into the Social Security system? We've heard it described tonight as not solving the solvency problem. He's clearly got he's clearly driven by something more than just the solvency issue. There'll have to be benefit cuts or something to make that happen. What do you see driving the president on this front? Arianna Huffington says to make people rich on Wall Street. How do you read it?
No, there's a false choice. I think like the moon landing, the Louisiana Purchase, like any kind of transformative change in America, there are ways to do this, and it will involve some borrowing. And I think it's investing in the future. Other countries have gone precisely down this path. If you go to Britain today, Tony Blair's Labour government has taken the Social Security personalization, which is what they call it there, further than Margaret Thatcher did. You go to Poland, socialist government has taken Social Security and given people personal accounts. Chile, a socialist government, has expanded the personal accounts that are in Chile. 15 countries around the world, governments from ranging from left to right, have done this. This is not controversial, at least in the rest of the world. As for Iraq, I just have to say one quick thing.
Please.
One of the things about present trends continuing thinking is that sometimes present trends don't continue.
Mm-hmm.
The administration was wrong that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It was wrong that it was going to be a cakewalk. Well, the critics were right, but the critics are not going to always be right. I can give you lots of quotes from Jimmy Carter last year who said he was convinced the election was not going to go on.
It'll never happen. It'll be a meltdown.
I have George Soros here who called the election a sham. I have people who said that the casualties would be in the 5,000 to 50,000 range. Turns out they were 50. So, look, the administration was wrong on Iraq, on the weapons of mass destruction, and other fundamental issues. I don't think the critics should open their eyes and look at the evidence and concede that maybe present trends don't always continue. Maybe Iraq is not doomed to be a complete disaster and a complete hellhole forever. Like Afghanistan, maybe there will be sprouts of optimism and hope. If you go to Afghanistan, the situation there is a whole lot better than it was 18 months ago.
All right, we've got a lot on the table here. I want to get our callers in this conversation as well. We're talking tonight with Arianna Huffington, John Fund, our own Jack Beatty is here. Right now, Aureliano is calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Aureliano, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, what are you thinking?
Well, I have a fundamental, specific issue about a fundamental assumption of the proposed change to Social Security.
Okay, let's hear it.
My concern is that we are assuming that the general people, the general population, is able to make appropriate investment decisions. And that's a big assumption because even I consider myself an educated professional, and I recognize the challenges of being able to make money as you invest yourself.
Right.
So I am concerned about elderly people and people that do not have the same level of education.
They may not have the expertise to go into the market and actually do well. Aureliano, we've got it. And let us pick that up. Arianna Huffington, how about it? Social Security may or may not be in a crisis, but it does have some problems looming out there. Why not get some market returns into this? Is it just too daunting for ordinary Americans?
Well, actually, the caller made a very good point, which basically is the point that how do you maintain Social Security as a safety net program while transforming it into a 401k program, basically? And you can't do both. You cannot both privatize it and maintain it as a safety net program, which has changed the way all the people live in this country. And that's the fundamental problem, plus the fact that the president has not told us, and maybe he will tell us tonight, how he's planning to pay for it.
John Fund, there's talk of starting small with personal investment accounts, but there are some who would like to see the whole system pretty much go that way. Are you in that camp? Do you think we should take away the kind of guaranteed retirement return, get everybody substantially deeper into the market with their retirement funds?
That's not on the table. No one is proposing that.
I realize it's not on the table, but we hear in the background
$1,000
personal accounts is the whole show.
Nothing that the president is going to talk about tonight has not been tried in other countries. Britain, if Arianna wishes to go to Britain, you know, I'll grubstake her a few hundred dollars for a plane ticket. She can go there and she can interview Frank Field, who's the former Labor Minister of Social Security, and he will tell her, we have a guaranteed benefit in Britain. We also have personal accounts.
We've got that. We're going to pick that subject up in real depth later on this week. But I guess my question is, how far do you see the president and his backers ultimately wanting to go with privatization? How far beyond $1,000 accounts?
About as far as Britain has, which is under a Labor government.
And so take it there. Jack Beatty, well, here we've got a couple of different views. On Social Security, it's not a crisis, and you don't want to get everybody onto Wall Street. On Iraq, John Fund says, don't assume that past performance is any guarantee of future screw-ups.
Well, you know, he may have a point there. I mean, one of the issues with Iraq is, will the Iraqis fight for their own country? Will they essentially do what peoples have had to do around the world, which is stand up for their own freedom? And we're going to find that out this year. We have discovered last year that in many cases that wasn't so, and people said that Iraqi units wouldn't fight, or they fought poorly. And the reason seemed to be that they thought they were fighting for the Americans. Well, now they have some stake in their country. Will that make a difference? Will that allow us, our soldiers, to come home sooner? We don't know.
Arianna Huffington, we heard earlier the governor of North Dakota, John Hovind, saying what he likes about President Bush, who will be on Air Force One with tomorrow morning, is that he's a bold leader. He stands up. He says just what he wants. The president won re-election with that kind of posture. Is it still working? It's only a few months later here. Should we assume the president still got a pretty good hold on the American public?
Well, one of the reasons he does is because of the absence of a strong and bold opposition. John has been talking a lot about Britain. Well, I think the model that works in Britain is the model of the loyal opposition. We don't have that. We don't have somebody standing up and clarifying for the American people why the war in Iraq remains the wrong war at the wrong place in the wrong time, and why we're less safe because of it. That's really the key. We went to war to make us more safe, to avenge 9/11. None of that has happened, and the spread of anti-Americanism because of the war in Iraq, the fact that as an exhaustive report released last month by the CIA's National Intelligence Council shows, Iraq has become a breeding ground for the next generation of professionalized Islamic terrorists. That does not make America more safe. And that really is the fundamental responsibility of government. It's not the fundamental responsibility of government to so-called spread democracy and freedom abroad.
So there we go. Two views of the State of the Union. Arianna Huffington, trouble ahead, maybe trouble right now, and John Fund. We've got leadership here, and let's give it a chance for the next go-around. John Fund with The Wall Street Journal, Arianna Huffington in California. Thanks so much to
both of you
for being with us tonight. We're talking about the State of the Union in advance of the President's State of the Union address. You can join the conversation. What do you want to hear from President Bush tonight? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the state of the American Union in advance of the President's State of the Union address coming up in just about 20 minutes now. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you see the State of the Union on this February 9th, 2005? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, our news analyst, is with us tonight, and we are joined now from Washington by Thomas Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. Tom Frank, thanks for being with us tonight.
How are you guys tonight?
We're terrific. Also with us from Palo Alto, California, Michael Boskin, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor of economics at Stanford University, served as chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors from 1989 to 1993. That would be the time of Bush Sr. Michael Boskin, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
Michael Boskin, first to you, if I may. On the economy front, how do you see the State of the Union tonight? We've seen ups and downs and some pretty extended downs during the first 4 years of President Bush's administration, but things also described as coming together. How do you see the big frame of the U.S. economy? How's it positioned?
That's a good question. The current state of the American economy is good. Not great, but good and getting better. It remarkably survived the stock market bubble crash, the recession, terrorism, and has been in expansion for quite some time. And fortunately, it's been creating jobs for a year and a half now. And the economy is doing well. It grew last year at over 4%. It was the best growth year we had in several years. The unemployment rate is below the average for the last 30 years at 5.4%. Inflation's low. While the Federal Reserve is moving interest rates back to a more normal range at the short end, they're still low. So overall, you'd have to say the economy is in pretty good shape. We have pockets of weakness. We have issues. We have issues to address. But overall, the economy is in good shape.
So when you look at the president's stewardship in these 4 years, despite the hits the economy take, what kind of grade do you give him?
I give him very high marks. I think that it was the best use of countercyclical fiscal policy in a generation. I think he gets good marks on tax policy, the structural tax reforms he's introduced, the lower rates, the dividend and capital gains relief, and things of that sort are precisely what we all teach to our students in academia these days. And I think he gets good marks in a number of areas. It was far from perfect. There was too much non-defense spending growth, and I think you'll hear more from him tonight about continuing the control he finally put in last year on that.
Fiscal austerity on the docket tonight.
And also there were a couple of other ways he strayed off the reservation temporarily, like steel tariffs, but fortunately they've been removed.
Mm-hmm. Thomas Frank, you wrote What's the Matter with Kansas? I'm guessing you've got a contrary view here, so let's ask you, what's the matter with the State of the Union tonight?
Well, you know, I actually wasn't going to I wasn't going to talk about the, you know, how, whether the economy was up or the economy was down or anything like that.
Take the angle you like, my friend.
Okay. I was going to take a long-term view
mm-hmm.
and think about what the president's agenda means in a sort of historical sense and the kind of the sort of ideology of the free market over everything that we see in his idea of the opportunity society and you know, his phrase, the opportunity society.
Or ownership society, very often.
Security.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my discipline isn't economics, it's history. And in history, you know, when we look back at, you know, the Roosevelt era and before, you know, mm-hmm. when Social Security began, we think about how long it took for Americans to, you know, to learn how foolish it was to entrust the free market with organizing their society, because the free market leaves so much up to chance. It destroys people's lives. It destroys entire, you know, classes of people, farmers, workers, unlucky speculators. And I always think of the generation of historians from the 40s and the 50s and even the 1960s. They used to call them the consensus historians, who understood, you know, the broad sweep of American history as a kind of story of enlightenment, as people gradually came to figure this out and to realize that they could bring market forces to heal, that acting all together, we could abolish things like age-old poverty and, you know, FDR sort of being the hero of this movement. And when you look at it this way, what we're witnessing, it seems to me, is the destruction of that way of thinking, that kind of civic spirit.
But why, if that was the lesson learned, why was President Bush elected just a few months ago? I mean, he's singing a completely different song.
No, I mean, that was the lesson learned in the 1920s.
Well, but what happened to that? I mean, Americans don't seem to be assessing things that way right now.
It is actually very deeply ironic that we're considering, going to a privatized, a privatized Social Security system in just 4 years after a sort of, a very traumatic stock market collapse. But I was actually, it's funny that you asked that, because earlier today, anticipating exactly that question, I went back and looked at that that exit poll that the news organizations did to see, how many people voted for the president because of his Social Security privatization scheme. And it's weird, it didn't even come up. It was the main factors, the main reasons why people gave for voting for reelecting the president were, as you know, the values issue, remember, and the war on terrorism. This was barely discussed.
I have a somewhat different take on
Michael Boskin
on this. First of all, with all due regard, this isn't the 1930s anymore. We are a much richer society. We have much more experience with a large, much larger fraction of our population dealing with market institutions. While there certainly is an important role for government to play, including as an important role as a safety net, we've seen what the free market can do. We've seen that there's never been a time in our history, in world history, where a larger number of people, a larger fraction of the world population, has been lifted out of destitution as there has been in the last quarter century.
Michael Boskin.
If we want to know how important it is to have a large oppressive government, compare East and West Germany, compare North and South Korea, compare France and Germany to the United States. The kinds of things that we're trying to do is avoid going down the path that has gotten the Europeans into a situation where they have permanent economic stagnation, socioeconomic ossification, double-digit unemployment, and they feel good about the fact that they're all in this mess together.
So the learning that you see going on here, the Enlightenment is just the opposite of what Thomas Frank is pointing to. It's free market.
Any fair reading of history would say that the free market has been the greatest engine of prosperity in human history, aside from its consistency with freedom of choice and liberty and things of that sort.
I want to get our listeners in here. Herb is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Herb. You're on the air.
Yes, I find it more than passing strange that while Mr. Boskin is quite willing to criticize the Europeans, they have a welcome mat for U.S. Investment coming from Europe. The United States imports $590 billion to cover the current account deficit, which, as it turns out, is about two-thirds of the entire world's savings.
That's a lot of debt.
That's unsustainable. The Bank of Japan alone loaned $278 billion last year, and while George Bush is willing to criticize Social Security, the true deficit for 2004 was $578 billion. They called it $412 billion because they looted $166 billion from Social Security.
Right.
I find that very, very hypocritical. The other thing is, too, that 9% of the nation's gross domestic product, over $900 billion, is under the radar screen. It's illegal. It's untaxed, unregulated. It's everything.
You're talking black market economy, but sitting right there in front, those deficits, and they certainly are big. Herb, thanks for calling. Michael Boskin, how about that? On the deficit side, what's the state of the union?
Well, we have work to do. It was the right thing to run large deficits relative to the size of the economy in war and recession and early in the recovery. As we're moving back to full employment, as the military spending needs abate over the next couple of years, we should be moving back to a budget that is much closer to balance.
But what about the current account deficit, that trade deficit?
The current account deficit is another issue. It's the gentleman's right. It's not sustainable forever. It comes from a variety of sources, including the fact that foreigners want to invest in the United States because we're the only large major economy that does well, that grows, where returns are reasonable, where you have a very high likelihood that you're not going to have your funds expropriated. So there are lots of reasons for foreigners to invest here. That being said, we do need to save more as a nation, both privately. Personal saving needs to go up, and the president's proposed some savings incentives to do that. And we need to get our budget deficit down. We spend too much in the public sector, both because of the deficit and also because a lot of government spending is not very target effective or cost conscious.
Michael Boskin, stand by. Thomas Frank, I want to give you another swing at the free market dynamic here. Freedom is a big word for this president, and he unstintingly goes to the free market. He naturally goes there. Michael Boskin says that's the enlightenment that we got out of the 20th century, was that it works.
Yeah, and you know, it's a funny thing because in the 50s and 60s, when the American economy was much more heavily regulated than it is now, and you had a much greater commitment to the social welfare state, you actually saw, you know, growth was considerably greater then. The idea that the U.S. is like East Germany if we don't privatize Social Security is frankly ridiculous.
That's not what I said. I said if you want to see what an oppressive government can do, compare that.
He was comparing.
We had a separate argument about Social Security privatization. We did have a strong growth in the 50s and 60s because there was a pent-up demand from the Great Depression, and there was the technology from the war, and it was from a much lower base. We grew less rapidly than the Europeans in the 1950s. Okay. However, in the last 20 years, as the Europeans have seen their welfare states explode, and as we approach that up to 1980, but it was fortunately stopped by Reagan and others that came after him, we called a halt to that. And that was the right thing to do, to stabilize the share of government in the economy, to try to get more effective, more efficient government.
Thomas Frank, let me ask you, if I may, Michael Boskin. Thomas Frank, American voters seem to be overall kind of on board with Boskin's view here. Do you see anything turning that around? When the president speaks to the country tonight, is he kind of speaking to the choir?
I would say that Social Security privatization is going to turn out to be deeply unpopular. It may not be right now, but you give it a couple of years and it will be.
Jack Beatty.
The president is not going to propose privatizing Social Security. He is going to propose adding a personal account component to Social Security where people voluntarily can divert a small fraction of their payroll taxes into a personal account that will be investable in a small, highly diversified, carefully designed set of investments like the Federal Thrift Savings Plan. Now, it's certainly clear that I strongly support this. There are arguments for it and arguments against it. But to start saying like he's choosing to dismantle Social Security, read what the leading Democrats have said about this. John Kennedy, when he was president, said Social Security cannot remain stagnant. It cannot remain static. It's got to change with the times as we become richer, as our demography change. We had 41 workers per retiree when Social Security was created, 16 in 1950, the era that your other guest seems to love the most. Going on, we have 3.25 now. We're going to have 2. We do not have a situation where we are currently where we are on the Titanic about to hit the iceberg. But we do know almost certainly that if we don't do something soon, we will be in a situation where it is likely we will be in a Titanic about to hit an iceberg. So it makes sense to make some changes now that are sensible. Nobody's benefits are going to be cut. It's going to stay the same for people who are already retired and over 55.
Nobody's benefit cut for now. Michael Boskin, I want to get our analyst Jack Beatty in here. Jack, two very different worldviews here. Michael Boskin's the one the president's going to carry with him to the podium tonight. Americans, though, at the same time, Thomas Frank, I think, is right, that Social Security hits so many people so intimately that this is a moment where Americans are likely to sit back and think very carefully about the visions being spun out here, and they don't line up. They're two different visions, but there's a problem at the heart of it. Social Security does have issues.
It does. The White House now calls them problems, not a crisis. Social Security means a lot to people, and as their polls show, it all depends how it's explained to them. If they see this as a trade-off, we're going to have to trade certain benefits for the risky gain in the stock market, they don't like it so much. So it depends upon who's going to explain this most lucidly, and I think the president's going to take a first whack at it. But you know, Professor Boskin is in a discipline that's all about interconnectedness. That's the great thing about it.
Economics.
Absolutely, one thing connects to another. Mm-hmm. And you know, on the one hand, Professor tells us we do have this savings crisis, and we do need to deal with this current account deficit and so on, budget deficit. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he says Social Security privatization be a good idea. Well, according to Paul Krugman, over the next 20 or 30 years, this could be, you know, a $10 or $12 trillion addition to the deficit. You know, you got to choose. Do you want to have fiscal sobriety or do you want to privatize Social Security? But the two things would seem to me to be in conflict.
Michael Boskin?
Well, the president is not going to propose privatizing Social Security. He's going to propose adding a personal account component. There are a modest voluntary personal account component. There are many ways to do that where national saving will not go down, will in fact go up. There are many studies, including your coming from Boston, from Martin Feldstein from Harvard is the first person who started raising this issue, that Social Security, in fact, has discouraged people, some people from saving for their own retirement. So there are many ways to design this that protects people who are likely to be left behind, protects people from taking flyers on a wild stock, that they're broadly diversified in a series of mutual funds. There are many ways to design this that minimize the risk that we're talking about. But the one thing we know is the current system is promising much larger inflation-adjusted benefits to people in the distant future that cannot be financed under current payroll tax regimes.
Our time grows short, Thomas Frank.
Take the chance on raising a large increase in payroll taxes, tanking the economy permanently, like the Europeans have done, then that's the route you want to go.
We hear you. Thomas Frank, a last swing at bat here goes to you. Do you see Americans looking a new way here or going with the President Bush's song?
They're going in the old way. They're going in the 19th century way. And I would just leave you with one thought, which is about the political power of Wall Street. Okay, this is, Wall Street, we often think of it as being politically neutral, but of course that isn't the case. Wall Street has a political agenda. Wall Street likes businesses to hold the line on wages. It likes management to have a free hand for outsourcing, polluting, that sort of thing. Once you entrust Wall Street with the nation's retirement savings or with the fate of our retirees, you're essentially making Wall Street's politics the de facto economic policy of this country, and that's what this is ultimately all about.
And maybe President Bush would be happy to say amen, and why not?
Right.
It's the free market.
He has not yet even mentioned whether Wall Street's going to have anything to do with the management of the money.
Well, with that, we're out of time. Thomas Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas, and Michael Boskin at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, thanks to both of you for being with us tonight. Jack Beatty, we've got 1 minute left. The president is no doubt under the Capitol Dome somewhere right now, ready to step out into the spotlight. And here he is, starting his new term, the big freedom speech given at the inaugural behind him, now down into the dirt of it.
Down into the dirt of it, and I do think that he gets something out of that election. I mean, people were saying the opposite, that if the election had gone bad, I don't know what they meant by that, that would negatively affect him. I think that it went good, or at least can be spun that way. I think that does help him.
The president saying, let's look for upside surprises here. We had one on Sunday. We can get one maybe from the markets, maybe get a little upside surprise in investing Social Security funds. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight. We'll all be watching. Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston.